I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome back to Radio Times. Our guest, Margot Jefferson, was a member of Chicago's black upper class, the daughter of a physician and a socialite. She calls this world Negro Land, the title of her memoir about growing up in the 1950s and how that has shaped her life. And while she enjoyed a life of privilege and plenty, it came with a steep price. She writes, "Inside the race, we were self-designated aristocrats, educated, affluent, accomplished. To Caucasians, we were oddities, underdogs, and interlopers." Margot Jefferson won a Pulitzer Prize for criticism, worked for years as a theater and book critic for Newsweek and also for the New York Times, wrote a book called On Michael Jackson, and is a professor of writing at Columbia University School of the Arts. And she joins us from the NPR studios in New York. And Margot Jefferson, a great pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Nice to have you with us. I'd love to have you begin with a reading from your memoir, Negro Land.
All right. I'm a chronicler of Negro Land, a participant observer, an elegist, dissenter, and admirer, sometimes expatriate, ongoing interlocutor. I call it Negro Land because I still find Negro a word of wonders, glorious and terrible, a word for runaway slave posters and civil rights proclamations, for social constructs and street corner flaunts. A tonal language word whose meaning shift as setting and context shifts, as history twists, lurches, advances, and stagnates, as capital letters appear to enhance its dignity, as other nomenclatures arise to challenge its primacy. I call it Negro Land because Negro dominated our history for so long, because I lived with its meanings and intimations for so long, because they were essential to my first discoveries of what race meant, or, as we now say, how race was constructed. For nearly 200 years, we in Negroland have called ourselves all manner of things, like the colored aristocracy, the colored elite, the colored 400, the 400, the blue vein society, the big families, the old families, the old settlers, the pioneers, Negro society, black society, the Negro, the black, the African American, upper class, or elite.
And again, that's our guest, Margot Jefferson, reading from the beginning of her memoir called Negro Land. Are you trying to reclaim the word Negro?
No. I am using it for very particular purposes, and partly to recreate a social and cultural time. Also, you know, it's very interesting when a group, when people are called by so many names. It always reflects the instability and the changeability of their status. And, you know, Negro is one of so many, but it was the honorific. It was the desired and respected term among colored Negro and black people, really from about, by the 20s, it was getting firmly established. You know, the Harlem Renaissance, all those writers and artists called themselves Negroes. And it became challenged and began to lose its credibility in the 60s when Black Power moved in. So,
well,
no.
No, I hear you. But it is, I mean, and I'm a white girl here talking to you. So for, you know, you hear that word every now and then, not in your book necessarily, but sort of out in the world. And there is something jarring about it, I have to say.
It feels dated, absolutely. I know that. But again, I'm using it to convey, a particular period and a series of assumptions, habits, conventions, etc. So I meant it to jar a bit, so people would have to think about, sequences of names and their meanings and the myths and assumptions and politics within and around them.
Tell us what it meant then to be a good Negro girl in the 1950s. And, I mean, you certainly were a good Negro girl, were you not?
I performed my role admirably.
And it did require performance, yes?
Well, this entire world required performance and race relations, as we used to call them. That's another kind of dated phrase, isn't it?
It is.
That required a lot of performances, too. A good Negro girl was simultaneously representing, you know, the race at its supposed best and womanhood. Really descending essentially from Victorian ideology of, you know, what a lady was, what desirable feminine traits were. So,
well, you have a whole chapter on skin color, grades of hair, noses, the Jefferson girls and ballet, the Jefferson girls and beauty. I mean, there were a lot of, I don't know if rules is exactly the word, but
absolutely. This
requirements.
Is
go ahead.
Absolutely. And this is the stuff of feminine culture, period, across and through every, you know, racial and class, every racial designation and class designation, the intensity of it within my world, you know, because every single thing about a Negro, a black person's external and internal behavior signified something about, you know, what white society thought of us, how they designated us, how they looked for justifications to confine, oppress, or, in fact, to support and help advance our cause.
You write gloves, handkerchiefs, pocketbooks for all occasions, good diction for all occasions, skin care, no ashy knees or elbows, hair cultivation, a ceaseless round of treatments to eradicate the bushy and nappy, manners to please grandparents and quell the doubts of any white strangers loitering to observe your behavior in schools, stores, and restaurants. So constantly being judged about how you looked, how you behaved, how you spoke.
Yes. Because all of those things signified, you know, what Negroes were, what, you know, what claim we had to equality.
You also call I get the sense from how you write about your growing up in Chicago, living in your own sort of unique world. I think you call it the third race. So it's not the white race.
I say we thought of ourselves often as. Exactly. No, it's not the white race, but it's not, you know, the larger mass of black people whom we, you know, were, of course, interacted with, but with a lot of class snobbery and, you know, and pride, both things, they often overlap, held ourselves apart from. We thought that we should be the model for what all black people needed to do.
Did you think
to help
you were
advance and improve the race?
Right. Did you think you were better than other black people?
Don't all people of a bourgeoisie think that they're better than exactly. those who are considered working class? Is that right. a rhetorical
yes,
question?
I hear you.
Okay. Right. There, you're a white girl who knows exactly what I'm talking about.
Well, tell us about your parents. Your dad was a very well-known, very respected physician. You describe your mom as a socialite. Tell us a bit about...
You know, she actually began as a young woman, as a social worker. And once she married and, you know, she and my father, again, like so many couples, this is post-war America. And what is the privileged woman, lady, supposed to do, really, in the haute bourgeois family? She is supposed to be at home, isn't she? You know, some worked. You know, there were lawyers, doctors, a lot of school teachers. But, you know, the privilege, particularly in black history when, you know, women had to labor, you know, so many jobs, taking care of so much, the privilege of being able to stay at home and see to your family and your home, that was not taken lightly. It was, and again, very much in line with the history, if you will, of definitions of what women should be. Black women had been so excluded from the rewards of that history. We now know those rewards can be very treacherous, that we were eager to claim them. So, you know, yes, my mother was, what do socialites do? She was also a very attentive parent in terms of my sister and me. Socialites, they join clubs, they give parties, they do civic things, they do charity work. Yes, all of the above.
And you had
very involved in the arts, yes.
And you had a Mrs. Blake who worked for the family.
She was the cleaning woman, yes.
And she was a black, I mean, she was a black woman. A lot of
yes.
white families have done this, and I don't know if the dynamic is any different in a family such as the one that you grew up in Chicago.
You mean the dynamic of a
of race.
Black family employing black cleaning yeah. women, maids, whatever? I am not sure how different it is. I think it very much depends on the relationship between the employee and the employer. I think there were moments when, you know, Mrs. Blake, whom we definitely were instructed to call Mrs. Blake, we
right.
did not call her by her first name,
right.
When she would, confide in my mother a little bit about white families she worked for, if they had done something she didn't like. But I also remember my mother telling me that when Mrs. Blake asked a number of the black women she worked for to contribute to her Social Security, my mother did, others did, but not all of them wanted to.
Oh, interesting.
And my mother said about one of her friends, she said, Riley, she said, she would rather be, the benevolent mistress giving Mrs. Blake gifts and cash here or there, but Mrs. Blake wants her Social Security. So, class can definitely trump racial solidarity.
Well, about a minute before our first break here, you had several times asked your mother, are we rich? I mean, and I don't think that's an unusual question for children to sometimes ask their
parents. I agree. Yeah.
Trying to sort of understand, so where do we fit into this hierarchy?
Exactly. And I actually asked, you're right, it's very common. And every child has some reason, something they're perceiving in the world around them that makes them ask. I asked because someone at my school, a white schoolmate, had asked me. And, I was very interested. You're already, as a child, indeed perceiving these, what we now call difference, and shades of meaning, this move between tension and ease. So, that sparked curiosity. I must have been aware that we were considered distinctive, even unusual, as a black family that seemed to have as much as any of the white families at my school.
And that's Margot Jefferson, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. She's got a memoir, and it's titled Negroland. That's what we're talking about in this hour of Radio Times. She's had a long career as a theater book critic, and she currently is a professor of writing at Columbia University School of the Arts. And she's speaking at the Free Library of Philadelphia tomorrow and joins us on Radio Times, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe talking with Margot Jefferson. And again, she's been talking about growing up in the 1950s, a member of Chicago's black upper class. It came with privilege and plenty, but certainly many social pressures. That's what she writes about in her memoir, where girls of her generation, her status, live by a motto of achievement, invulnerability, and comportment. 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. You know, having read your memoir, Margot, and then I looked at the pictures, and there are several pictures of you as a cheerleader, your graduation picture. You talk about performance. And so in reading about, and certainly as you look back on your life, I mean, it's clear there were a lot of pressures on girls like you to behave a certain kind of way. And yet all those pictures are just a picture of happiness and health and connection. We see you as a cheerleader. I think there's another black girl with you, and everyone else
Indeed.
Is white. Yeah.
One of my best friends.
Yes. Yeah. So how do... What were all the things that you write about now, were they going on inside you at the time, or is this something you've sort of come to understand as an adult?
It's something I've come more and more to understand. I think all people live on many tracks. Saying that we perform is not saying that we are fake, particularly in adolescence. You can want very much to be a certain kind of, popular. Let's leave it with girls.
Sure.
At this point. Popular, vivacious girl. At the same time, which was also true of me, you can long to be artistic, and eccentric and unusual, but not quite know how to do that and still be a popular, vivacious girl. Mm. You have moments racially, of intense awareness when... ugly moments, distasteful moments, jarring moments. I think one is always aware somewhere, but, this is where we have a subconscious and an unconscious of racial expectations and pressures. At the same time, life day mm-hmm. by day, I had many of us had, good friends, fun times. I had a group of black friends, some of whom were with me in school, but all not, of whom were not. I had white friends in school. There was a life of, plenty and fun, as well as a life of, reflection and what became a kind of growing alienation, I think. In those days, and I have found this talking to many, many old friends, black certainly, but white as well. We were so silent in the 50s and 60s, early 60s, about who talked about troubled marriages, mm-hmm. Or mm-hmm. a drunken parent, let's say, who admitted that they had almost had a kind of nervous collapse. We didn't know this about each other.
And now we do.
Unless someone acted it out flagrantly. The self-destructive kid, these are things that I became aware of, my needs, my struggles, my griefs as I grew older. I think it probably started in college. I was at college in 64 to 68. Tumultuous times. Politically, socially, culturally, and those things, stir you up inside. They make you aware of all kinds of things you didn't know about yourself before.
Certainly, and in many ways, that is what college can be about. You write about...
Especially in a charged time.
Sure, you talk about the civil rights movement that your parents were, very much in support of, but then comes Black Power in the 1960s.
And which belongs to my generation.
Well, exactly. Right. Can you talk a bit about that and whether as a... as a young woman that came from this more privileged background, was that a liability?
It sometimes was, yes, because you had to do. Black Power was, it was leftist. we're talking about the New Left, Black Power, et cetera, et cetera. So you had to do a critique of your class privilege, if I may use those words.
Sure. They're a familiar ring to me, yes.
Yes, okay. that was supposed to be an act of good faith. And yes, it could certainly be considered a liability. It was part of the critique. Turnabout is fair play, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It could be painful, absolutely. But I would not have had any of those experiences.
The feminist movement, as it is described, is sometimes criticized for being a white woman's movement. And I wonder whether you think, if that from your own experience, is that a Is that a wrongful critique? Does that sort of distract us from perhaps some of what was really going on in the movement at the time?
It's not a wrongful critique. It's important to know and for me to say that Black feminist movement, Black feminism, was evolving at the same time in response to, let's call it race and class, a certain racial and class obliviousness or naivete or lack of interest, or sometimes hostility on the part of some white feminists. So we evolved our own movement. There was also a lot of, there was hostility, there was suspicion from many Black men. Uh-huh. Black power had been a very male-dominated movement. So, we were working between both of these and struggling very hard with the following the lead of women like Florence Kennedy, Faith Ringgold, mm-hmm. trying very hard to come up with a feminism that would take in, that included a racial analysis.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Margot Jefferson, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, joining us from the NPR studios in New York. And we've been talking about her memoir published just a couple of months ago called Negro Land. And I should add that she will be in Philadelphia tomorrow speaking at the Free Library of Philadelphia. And we wanted to get her on Radio Times to talk about her life and what her life has taught her about this country and issues about race and class. 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. This is a bit jarring, but I just wanted to read one of the chapters you begin in the late 1970s. I began to actively cultivate a desire to kill myself. I was at the time a successful professional in my chosen field of journalism. I was also a passionate feminist who refused to admit any contradiction between. And you go on to describe really almost going through the steps of what it would be like to literally stick your head in the oven.
Making it a kind of ritual.
Yes, exactly.
A kind of performance ritual, yeah.
What was your distress?
I was, I believe, internally utterly exhausted and very angry. I think, anyone who has had anything to do with depression, melancholia, suicidal longings knows that depression and suicidal longing have a large element of anger in them. So both. And I think it was this accumulation of fatigue and resentment at these years of, performing to be this symbol, this ritual, and additionally, knowing many privileges were involved, and not knowing, feeling I could never live up to a kind of expectation of perfection. I was angry and I was tired, and this ritual helped me give a kind of structure to feeling overwhelmed by a kind of depression. Why would I say a kind of? I was also, full still of a kind of vivacious energy. So, I would be caught so unawares over and over by these sudden plunges. And that, too, was confusing and exhausting. And I couldn't see a way through to make more sense of these pieces, the personal, the political, the historical, and the very, very intimate private self.
And you say such a
fact. I felt very blocked.
Yes. And reading your book, I that was very loud and clear. But you also say such a fascinating thing about depression for you and perhaps even for other Black women, that you talk about the sort of white female privilege of allowing oneself to be depressed. But because of the history of slavery and of
and it being in a sense almost encouraged, which is treacherous and punitive. But there is a almost occult. There was a kind of historical and literary and
artistic, you know, cult of the beautiful, the frail, the very gifted, you know, deeply melancholic, sometimes suicidal. Sylvia Plath still, in some ways, sums it up. Now, that is painful and ugly. So, you know, I'm fully aware of the ironies of saying, you know, I was denied that. But black women, black girls from girlhood on, we had been taught, you know, because of the history of your people and the history of your sex, you must fight against every stereotype that says black women are not intelligent. They are oversexed. They are, you know, indiscriminately lust-ridden. They are not to be trusted. They are not this, that. You know, it was a history of negatives. We must overcome that. And the history that in fact challenged and did overcome it included this directive. You know? And that extends to black men, too. You know, weakness, depression, suicide, but those are signs of weakness and proof that racism has defeated you. You do not give in to that.
Well, I'm doing a lot of quoting from your book, but I'll do it again. You write, "We were to be ladies, responsible Negro women, and indomitable black women. We were not to be depressed or unduly high-strung. We were not to have nervous collapses. We had a legacy. We were too strong for that." I mean, was the thinking, and maybe it isn't the sort of rational thinking, which is look at what our ancestors went through, and in a sense, who are we to complain about feeling sad or depressed?
You bet. Absolutely. And, you know, yes. You put it quite well.
So how did you, I mean, you did not kill yourself, but you certainly thought about it. And as you say, you practiced it. So what
I
saved you?
Again.
And yeah, so what saved you?
Therapy saved me. And medication helped me. And one reason I wanted to write about this was exactly to push aside the prohibitions against talking about it, which are not completely, you know. I'm not the first person to write this, but I wanted to contribute to a more open acknowledgement and talk about this.
Did that feel scary or
yes,
like you were breaking
absolutely.
Some rules somehow?
Indeed. A lot of the book felt like I was breaking a rule because, again, one of the spoken and unspoken kind of rules of this world is, you know, you don't tell secrets that could be used against your people, against your race and your sex.
What do you think your parents would think of this memoir?
Well, my parents were incredibly proud of my writing, but I think they would have, amidst great pride, I know they would have mixed feelings. My mother saw some chapters. She died about a year ago. I made sure, frankly, and again, I think many memoirists struggle with this, I made sure, because she was in her 90s, and she's a major character in the book. She knew she would be, and she's, to me, a kind of wonderful character as well, though overwhelming. I made sure that the chapters she saw, I was publishing, you know, chapters in magazines as I went along, and I made sure that the ones she saw were ones I genuinely felt she would enjoy. She had seen a theater piece I did in the early 2000s, where I did, in fact, speak of this depression and suicide. And she had handled it very well. You know, she didn't lecture or reproach me. But, you know, she would periodically say things to me as I was writing. She'd be giving her encouragement. And then she'd say contemplatively, you know, as if it just had come into her head, she'd say, "You know, Margot, I'm a very private person."
With the idea that you should be, too.
The idea was also, be careful what you write about me.
Right. Oh,
but she
that
she was very good. Women of her generation, again, across many racial, were very good. Part of feminine training was the art of the double or triple message.
So talking around things rather than being overt or direct about it.
Exactly. And text, that you know contains sub and possibly subtext, and you had better figure that out.
Well, I am interested that this, and I don't want to make too much of it, there was a solo performance that you did. So was that... That was the starting point for the book, thinking if I can act it, perhaps I can write it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, to my surprise, and you know, I began to talk about, it did include this, you know, kind of suicidal ritual, but, you know, I was also talking about, you know, these, the whole structure of this world. And several incidents that I used in the theater piece definitely found their way in a different form into the book. So, yeah, why it seemed easier to write as a performance piece, you know, is still somewhat mysterious to me.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't know. Well, I had a small life in high school and college, as an actor. So maybe some, you know, some part of me wanted to connect with the writer. Or maybe somewhere I thought, okay, you say it out loud and people won't remember it quite as much. It's a little more evanescent than if it's on the page. So I needed to gather a little courage over the intervening years.
Did you enjoy it, though, when you were actually performing, in a sense, your life?
Intensely. I really did. Yeah.
Because you got an audience there, you've got...
I was speaking it. It really was the first time I had written it down. So that was the first step. It was all written. You know, it wasn't improvised. I had written it down. It was there. I knew I could do that. And then I spoke it. So the twofold thing, the double whammy, was immensely rewarding.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Margot Jefferson in this hour of Radio Times. In fact, talking about her memoir that was published just recently, and it is called Negroland. And she is a professor of writing at Columbia University School of the Arts. She won a Pulitzer Prize for criticism. She worked as a theater and book critic both for Newsweek and also for the New York Times. I want to get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. And again, if you're just joining us, Margot Jefferson is our guest. We're talking about her memoir, and it's titled Negroland, 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Carol from Wilmington, Delaware, to join our conversation. And Carol, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And thanks for writing this book, Margot. I'm from Chicago as well, and I grew up in the 70s, and that kind of still existed. And even though we admired places like Pill Hill and the like, looking in from the outside, they were fierce gatekeepers.
Yes.
And they, you know, it could have been the skin color line or the economic line. And it was almost as more painful than the gatekeeping that whites did, because we looked at them as our own kind.
Yes.
And but what I realized as I got older was that they were in a cage of racism just like we were. Theirs was just gilded, and ours was not so gilded. But that confined them, and it caused them great damage as well. So that's the comment
that's really, great, Carol. No, go ahead, Margot.
That's so well put, and thank you for that.
But the idea of gatekeeping and
yes.
I mean, that's such a powerful thing when you think about it.
Yes, and when it is your own people, you know, and my God, we were so, you know, it was so fraught. And Chicago is, you know, such a segregated, you know, mean city in those ways. Yes, the pain is acute.
We have an email from William wanting to know whether you had white ancestors in your family tree. And you do write about a great uncle, Lucius. Can you talk about
Lucius,
that?
Actually,
Lucius,
it is. Yeah.
Oh, is it?
Well,
okay.
You know, there were a number of them. He was one of the ones who actually passed over. But, you know, there were some great-greats and great-greats. You know, they were, in some cases, slaveholders. In other cases,
by the time we got, say, on my mother's side, for example, her grandfather was given land and I think money that helped him build a general store in Mississippi from his white father. So, you know, that's sometimes the way it worked. It worked, too. Uncle Lucius was on my father's side, and he was, here's where things got a little mysterious. He was either the full-blooded brother of my paternal grandmother, or he was a half-brother, in which case his father would have been white. But we don't know. He could also have looked the same way and had a, quote, black father. So, you know, his life is still a little mysterious. Like many Negroes who passed, you know, he simply crossed over at one point, established a life in the white world, and would periodically come back and visit relatives in Chicago. When he retired from his job, he actually moved back and to black Chicago and became, if you will, a Negro again. So
this is passing,
that was
right?
That was his retirement. He had been passing, and then he retired into Negro land.
Where he didn't No, go ahead.
Well, you know, it was still very fraught. He didn't have to lie. He didn't have to get into fights, which he apparently would sometimes with white people who said very racist things. But how could he explain why he was getting into a fight? You know, it was fraught for him, but it was difficult still. How do you just suddenly return to an old identity? He used to call my father and other relatives sometimes and say, accuse them of neglecting him. And I thought, that's so psychologically interesting. Mm-hmm. Talk about, you know, projecting back, right? But these kinds of stories, some with a lot of variations, were very, very common. In my parents' generation, and really had been very common for a couple of centuries.
As you said, you quote your mother quite a bit in this book, and at one point she says, you know, sometimes I almost forget I'm a Negro.
What
did she mean? Yeah, go ahead.
What she meant there, that's a letter of hers that I reprint, that she wrote shortly after she'd married my father, and they were young and happy, and they were he was in the army, an army doctor, and they were in the all-black Fort Huachuca in Arizona, and she's writing a dear friend of hers, and she's telling her to wish a third friend congratulations on her upcoming marriage, and she says, you know, if she's half as happy, you know, as I am, she'll be a lucky girl. She said, sometimes I almost forget I'm a Negro, and that's something, huh? And that's, to me, is an amazing statement of just that, the pleasure you get in just those free moments where you are, you know, you're living an ordinary life as a happy, in this case, wife. She was pregnant with my sister. Or, you know, as a happy anything, as someone who's going to a movie she likes. You know, it's just when that pressure, you know, of race consciousness, race discrimination isn't on you. You're just relieved of it.
Because oftentimes the white world never forgets someone is a Negro, if you know what I mean.
Yes, exactly. And therefore, you can never forget. You know, you need to be often on guard. But no, you know, we want our purely human moments. We have the right to them.
And again, Margo Jefferson, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, talking about her memoir. It's titled Negro Land. And again, you can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. An email from Paul. He says, I would be very interested to hear what Ms. Jefferson would say about the importance of dignity among black people, especially of a certain age and especially women. She wouldn't necessarily have to comment on the presidential primaries, but I do think dignity plays a role. It seems like everything leads to a presidential primary these days. But do you think about that word dignity?
Well, he said it's particularly around women, right?
Yeah.
So I'm a little confused because it would seem to me that the people who are really throwing away any kind of claim to honorable dignity, meaning, you know, you're being truthful, you're being principled, are men, largely, and particularly, and, well, entirely Republican men. So, you know, dignity can be, dignity has an interesting history in you know, it can be a mask, you know, Negroes should not clown or be too loud or you know, that's undignified. And I think that that's a trap. But, you know, the dignity of your principles, of speaking honestly and as truthfully as you can, the dignity of thinking carefully and long and hard about serious issues, I'm for that. But I think that can, a lot of people with a lot of behaviors and manners of all different kinds can display that. There's no one way to, you know, perform dignity.
You write about, you know, girls of your generation, I guess, and class, if I can put it that way, lived by a motto of achievement, invulnerability, and comportment.
I mean, oh, yeah.
That's a lot. You know, that's a lot to try to live up to. But do you?
Yeah, and it's that good, respectable, good behavior and gentility and manners and, you know, it's speaking of a gilded cage. That is the gilded cage historically for women.
And do you feel like you have been able to break out of that gilded cage?
You know, we all bear the marks of our history and our past, but I have worked very hard to move out of it. And I think in many ways I have, yes.
You went on to be obviously a writer, a cultural critic. Were you always interested in writing as a young person?
You know, I took it for granted. I always was told that I wrote well, and I enjoyed it. And yeah, that was fun. But I got interested in other things. I was very interested in music for a time, then in theater. I was an English major in college, but I really didn't, engage actively. You know, thinking of myself as a writer till that I got out of college and began to think about, and then the women's movement hit, and we all began to think, wait a minute, what are we doing with our lives? What are our talents? And that's when I began to think, wait a minute, I could move into the world with this.
Well, as you said, this book was a performance piece that you did, and you were a theater critic, so it's not like you weren't aware of the power of theater.
No, or, you know, it was a book critic much longer, really, in my writing life than a theater critic. So, you know, so I've always been a voracious reader, like all writers. So, you know, I knew and worshipped, wonderful writing, good writing. The power of the word, of style, of aesthetics. Yes, 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 yes.
Is it hard for a book critic to write a book or a
it's
memoir?
I think it's tricky for any kind of critic, you know, because that's working all the time. Oh, my God. And you can really start editing and censoring yourself. So what I tried to do was use it. I almost subtitled the book A Cultural Memoir, and then I decided not to because that's accurate. You know, it's personal and cultural, but I thought that sounds a little pretentious. But I really tried to use in the way I changed personas and points of view and all of that. I tried to use the critic in me to help look at this world and kind of study, you know, its manners and rituals and performances. And I tried to make it work to my advantage.
And who is on the cover of your book? It's a woman in a beautiful black woman. We don't see her whole face, but we certainly see her white gloves and her lovely suit.
Exactly. And then the strip of white at the top, you can read as you wish. It's kind of interesting. The book designer found this in Ebony magazine files, and it was a 1964 cover. And the young woman, when you see her full face, had a Jackie Kennedy pillbox hat on. So it absolutely sums up. And one friend of mine in particular, before we saw the full picture, she called me up and she said, "Margo, are you sure that's not me? I had that knockoff Chanel suit." It encapsulates a certain kind of girlhood into womanhood via being a lady, a stylish lady of that period.
How do you dress now?
Very differently. I dress in a lot of different ways, and that pleases me enormously. Well, I like bright colors. I like, in the 70s, I was a mini skirt girl, I like skirts longer now. I like pants. It's just a lot of different things.
You and I are pretty much the same age, and just the idea of sort of growing up in the 50s and the 60s. I mean, when you put those two decades together, they sort of collide together.
Oh, don't you remember? Yes. And it started with clothes for girls. It started in the early 60s, really, with Rudy Gernreich and the Mary Quant and the white boots, like 63, that was already happening. And it was all tied to the sexual revolution. But in some ways for us, for girls, it loosened you up. It could in its own way help find a route to feminism, shaking off all that good behavior and all those defining, confining accessories.
You wrote a book about Michael Jackson, who, is such a talented and in many ways tragic but enduring figure. And his music, I mean, when you hear it, even now, I mean, you can't not be moving and feeling moved by
absolutely
his music. What was your interest in him?
I thought he was just a performing genius. And that was exciting to me. And I had felt that since he emerged as, a little Jackson 5 in the 70s when I was in my 20s. I was also just fascinated, sometimes stricken, but always fascinated by all of the cultural conflicts and conundrums and crossovers that he embodied in his presence, in his wardrobe, in his behavior, in the tropes and the types that he was always playing, in his mutations, if you will. He embodied and represented so many cultural struggles, uncertainties, clashes. It was to me fascinating. And I always have had an interest in the life of child stars. Something about that being trained to perform and being a perfect performing child. And that's what you're rewarded for, which in some way also means, of course, you're an adult.
Well, and we're almost out of time here, but in certain, as you have described your childhood, there was a certain degree of performance in it as well.
So true. So this is very true. There's always something, probably unconscious, that helps create a through line, I think, not only through your, reviews and essays, but through your books as a writer. So, yeah.
Well, we're going to end on that note. Margo Jefferson, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
Thank you. You're very welcome. Professor of Writing at Columbia University School of the Arts. And again, her memoir is titled Negroland. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times and you can find out much more about this program, how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for the newsletter, listen to us on satellite radio. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Abby Sarfo, our intern. The show is produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. And yes, this week, Susan Greenbaum. I'm Artie Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.